Les colloques du Collège de France.
So I'm simply too young to have ever had the chance to personally interact with Zvi. So I mainly know him from his writings, and whenever I build with my own research on his work, I get always this good feeling to be truly standing on the shoulder of a giant. So it's a great honor to be here and give this paper, which is precisely on innovation. And this is joint work with Reiko, with Yui, who is here. You're going to see her later today. And Pete, whom you've just seen discussing UFOXPED. So what are we doing in this paper is we basically take a finance measure about the price-earnings ratio of firms and bring it to this literature of innovation and growth and show a method how this measure can be informative to get a sense about the growth potential and innovation potential of different firms. This is because the price-earnings ratio contains information about expected future rent growth of a firm, which is arguably related to the innovation activity. So what we do is then we build a tractable endogenous growth theory where at the core firms have idiosyncratic shocks to their step size of innovation. And then we show in this model how it generates, it's a very tractable model, but it generates heterogeneity in price-earnings ratio, it generates heterogeneity in markups and in firm size and growth contribution of those firms. And then we go to the data, we look at publicly listed firms in the US where we can observe the price-earnings ratio and apply our method to get a sense for the growth contribution of different firms. I should have said this is work in progress, I'm going to not give you some definite answers to all those points. So what is kind of the starting point in the literature? Well, a benchmark in the literature is Gibrard's law, which postulates that firm growth is unrelated to size. What we find, and I'm going to show you just in a minute, is that there is a clear violation of Gibrard's law. So we infer that small firms systematically contribute more to future growth than under Gibrard's law. The other benchmark in the literature is Lotmer's growth paper. Here we kind of contribute because we emphasize that there is an important challenge working through markups, the profitability of firms, not just the size, and we build this at the core of our theory, and then when you go to the data, we kind of use publicly listed firms to contribute to what they contribute to future growth. Kind of an advantage, just taking a step back, an advantage of our method is that we bring a new measure to this literature that is not relying on patents or R&D data, which is arguably scant for firms outside the manufacturing sector. So I think it's a contribution to just bring an additional novel measure to this literature. Good. The price of a firm is just the expected discounted sum of future earnings. If you then assume that interest rate and the growth rate is either IID or constant, then you arrive at this Gordon growth formula, which relates the price earnings ratio to G, which is the earnings expected earnings growth and the interest rate. And this is kind of what we're going to work with. So we go to the data, we kind of reformulate this Gordon growth formula, solve for G basically, and then you arrive at this equation. Price earnings ratio we see directly in the data, so we can read it off. We calibrate R, and in the baseline results I'm going to show you today, we just set it equal to 9%, which is the average we find in the data. But we have some robustness where we use firm-specific Rs. And then we basically get out a G for each firm, which is the expected average earnings growth for this firm. So this obviously contains information about future rents growth, arguably driven by R&D, R&D activity of those firms. And just to visualize this, a baseline case would be if Tobin's Q is 1. Suppose a firm is growing a lot, but actually it's not, the rents are not growing. It's just sitting on a given rent, and it's growing by just putting more capital, more labor, more factors, and Tobin's Q is 1, then actually this G in the formula should be 0. So it's really about the rents, not just about the size of the firm. So this is kind of why it's the difference is subtle, but it's a different measure. Okay, so just as an example, here is Ford and Tesla. P/E ratio of Ford and Tesla. Tesla is 13 times higher than Ford. If we apply this method, we see the implied G is very different, of course. And this arguably reflects that investors put their money and bet that Tesla has a higher growth potential in future. So here is when we apply this to publicly listed firms in the US. And here I plot this G that we back out as a bin scatter plot relative to normalized earnings. So those are the big firms, and those are the small firms. And this is the violation of Gebrard's law, because under Gebrard's law, you would see just a flat line. This is not what we find. We see a systematic relationship between this G and firm size. So this implies that we are going to back out that small firms are expected to contribute systematically more than under Gebrard's law to future growth. You also see this kind of economically the differences are significant. This is something I'm going to target in when we quantify the theory to illustrate the quantitative mechanism. So this is kind of 6.5%, and this is very close to zero. Yeah, and then we can go to the advantage of working with publicly listed firms. The CompuStat data is that you can also name firms, so we can go to tech firms and see what this method suggest, and this is kind of where we are planning to go with this project. So one applications we are talking about is precisely to also infer what is the expected contribution to growth of particular firms due to the new wave of AI technology. So you can go to the kind of Magnificent Seven firms. NVIDIA, for instance, it's small, but all those firms have systematically higher G bars, we back out, relative to the average firm. So, yeah, investors are expecting that they're going to contribute more. So, some more results that we find in the data is that, you might be worried that this is just noise, we back out. This is not the case. So, G bar is indeed very persistent over time. We also see that G-bar strongly predicts actual earnings growth in future. When we use this projection of G-bar to the actual earnings growth, we can decompose it into a contribution due to sales growth and a contribution due to earnings relative to sales. And what we see then, and this is interesting, is that 78% of this projection of G-bar on the actual earnings growth is driven by the ratio of earnings to sales. So this suggests that to a large extent, the channel is going through profitability, not just sheer size, but profitability, which speaks to a markup channel. Yeah, that's important, and this is something I'm going to target later as well. And this is kind of something that really we put at the core and made us write down this model that I'm going to show you. So here is the theory. It's very simple, standard preferences. Then we have a unit interval of intermediate goods that come at particular quality, and they are produced by J producers. And those J producers have the knowledge to produce at a particular quality in those lines, and they innovate endogenously. The quality distribution of those lines is endogenous due to innovation activity of firms, so they do creative destruction innovation. Technology to produce in a given line is very simple. Linear in labor and independent of the quality. So then, and this is kind of the main element here, is that their firms can innovate. So they have a convex R&D technology, so they can draw X lines by investing in R&D. They can draw X lines, randomly drawn lines. And in those lines, they make a step, innovation step of gamma. And gamma is a stochastic outcome. So gamma involves, we just assume two outcomes, high and low, and it involves according to a transition probability matrix, a Markov chain. So firms sometimes have a window of opportunity. They have the high gamma step size of innovation, and then, of course, they're incentivized to do more innovation. Yeah. Then the pricing decision. We assume Bertrand competition. With this Cobb-Douglas structure, the firms would like to have an infinite markup. They cannot do that because there is a fringe. So the second best quality producer serves as a fringe, and the markups they charge is just the gap in quality they have over their competitor, which is the second best producer, which is given by the gamma, the step size. So you're going to have heterogeneity in markups, and the markup depends on the step size the firm had at the time when it innovated in this particular line. So you have some markups that are high and some markups that are low. Yeah. Then in the firm problem, there are two individual state variables here. One is the number of lines, so how big the firm is, and the other one is how many of those lines, the fraction of lines, they innovated with the high step size and can charge a high markup. So these are then profits, number of lines. These are the number of lines where they had a high step when they innovated, and this is simply the profit function, and the number of lines with low step and the profit function. And earnings, how we define it in this paper, is simply profits minus the R&D expenses. We then go to the dynamic firm problem, and here we focus directly on a balanced growth path along which the total output growth is constant, equal to G, and the interest rate is constant, and firms face a rate of creative destruction. So they lose line at the constant rate. Then the firm problem is just simply kind of maximizing the value by choosing the R&D effort. And with those assumptions that we put in, you get a very simple solution, namely that the optimal R&D effort is independent of size here. So the number of lines they innovate is independent of size of the firm, but it depends crucially on the current gamma state. So of course, if firm have a high gamma, then this is a window of opportunity to now really invest in R&D and grow. Whereas if firms have a low gamma, they don't put so much R&D resources and might even shrink. But it's independent of size. Good. Then just closing the model, some accounting equations. So of course the rate of creative destruction and the growth rate is endogenous in this model. It's just taken as exogenous by the individual firm. And this is just the accounting equation. So the number of innovation by the share of high types step sizes and the share of low steps. And we're going to focus, as I said, on a balanced growth path where there is an ergodic distribution of types. So there will be a distribution of firm size and types in this economy converges to, and this is kind of what we focus on. Good. So what are the key predictions that come out of this simple theory? Firm size only depends on the entire history of gamma draws, because it depends how big I am today depends on the entire history, how often I was in the high state in the past, and how often I had this window of opportunity to really grow in size and invest in R&D. So the entire history depends pins down the firm size in this particular point, and that's why we're going to get a kind of a distribution of firm sizes in this model. However, as we just saw before, the current innovation effort doesn't depend on size. It only depends on the actual step size growing in this particular period. A firm's contribution to growth, if the step size draws are persistent to some extent, then the future contribution to growth of a particular firm is going to be correlated with the size, because the size depends on the entire history and the current step size, and this does allow you to predict that they're going to contribute more or less to future output growth. If it's IID, then there is no relationship. We're going to see that when I show you some model output. So more generally, this model allows you to connect the P ratio to infer expected. To infer expected step size dynamics and contributions to growth. Okay, so then we put some numbers on this just to illustrate also quantitatively what we get out of it. I'm going to be a little bit quick here. So the we target the initial graph I showed you with this maximum, this relationship of the G bar in size in earnings distribution between large and small firms. This is something we target. We also target this contribution of earnings over sales I was referring to, this 78%, because this speaks to this markup channel. And then I think the most of the other targets are relatively standard. So this is, of course, a simple numerical illustration. Those are the parameters we back out. Maybe the easiest to interpret is the step size difference, because this suggests that the markup difference that gain charges is 5 percentage points. So not huge. And maybe also interesting is the persistence of the Markov chain. So the low state is very persistent. Then what we get is indeed this relationship between earnings and G bar, as we saw in the data. So we get a negative relationship out because the innovation activity is unrelated to size. It just depends on the gamma. So you get kind of relatively quickly a downward sloping trend. Here is this relationship of today's sales and contribution to growth. And under if the step size draws are IID, then you will not get any relationship. Then you will get a flat line. The reason why we get some positive relationship is precisely because there is some persistence in the step size. Kind of another benchmark here is the 45 degree line. Under Gibrard's law, points would be along the 45 degree line. So kind of this is an important message. We are clearly not along the 45 degree line. So this model suggests that there is less contribution of to future growth that by small firms than under Gibrard's. It's more than the contribution to future output growth than under Gibrard's rule. Yeah. I mean, this is just a proof of concept. So in our framework, actually, if we play around with the Markov chain and with the step size differences, also this model can generate something like Gibrard's law. So it's not baked in that this model cannot produce it, but under this calibration we get it. Finally, let me show this you this. And this is kind of how, at least in the past, earnings growth relates to contribution to past growth. So in this model, there is really a clear connection between earnings growth and contribution to growth that we can exploit. So this will also hold for future earnings growth. It's just illustrated here for past earnings growth. This connection is less clear if you use past sales growth in this model as opposed to earnings growth. So it's really kind of earnings growth is a good predictor of contribution to growth. And this is kind of what we're going to exploit and then talk about the contribution to future growth of particular firms. Yeah. So let me wrap up. What we do here is we bring a standard measure in finance to this literature on growth and innovation, and show you a method how you can use this measure to infer expected future output contribution, growth contribution of different firms. Then we provide a simple theory that speaks to those things, and we are about to extend this theory in various directions to make it more quantitative, and then eventually address the big question out there, and kind of give you numbers also for individual firms. And as I said before, one application we plan to do is also with respect to AI. Thank you.
Great. Very glad to discuss this paper, Ideas, Rent, and Firm Growth. So the paper proposes a new method for calculating firm's contribution to growth. And the key is it doesn't require patent or R&D data. It doesn't require measurements of inputs to calculate productivity. So it can be applied to public firms beyond manufacturing. And the core idea is price-to-earnings ratio contains information about expected growth of future earnings. So I'm going to quickly summarize the paper in just two slides and then provide some comments. So on the empirical side, the paper recovers firm-level heterogeneity in expected cash flow growth. And first, it shows that Jibrat's law, which states that growth rate is independent of size, that doesn't hold in the data. Smaller firms, inferred from their price-earning ratio, seem to expect faster growth, meaning smaller firms on average have higher price-earning ratios. And the paper conducts this descriptive exercise to demonstrate growth contributions of notable firms in the data, Magnificent Seven, Walmart, and so on. Then it provides a novel Schumpeterian model with shocks to firms' innovation efficiency, or the step size of innovation. Use the model to model generates heterogeneous price-earning ratio, heterogeneity firm growth, and markups across firm size distribution. So on the empirical side, you know, the motivation really starts from this central knowledge in finance industry that firms or stocks with high PE ratios are growth stocks. So I'm going to express this PE ratio in terms of the current price, X current period earnings or X dividend price, and express it in terms of future earnings. So the paper expresses it in current earnings, but in future earnings, expressions are a little simpler. So price today, expressing future earnings, is just discounted of next period earning and two periods later and so forth. At least when the discount rate and growth rate are all deterministic, price is just next period earning divided by R minus G. So if we can measure R in the data and we observe price to earning ratio, implied growth is follows negatively to the inverse of PE ratio. So high PE ratio firms are inferred to have high expected growth. So key empirical finding, you know, besides the fact that Jibrat's law fails, you know, firms with higher earnings tend to have lower implied growth, the paper also finds that using this measure, the G that backs out actually predicts actual earning growth. And earning growth can be decomposed into a growth in profit margin versus growth in size. And the paper shows that most of the projection or the explanatory power of this predicted growth on actual earning growth comes from the ability to predict growth in profit margin, motivating the model to have growth margin differences across firms. And this implied growth is also persistent within firm. On the model side, you know, it's a Schumpeterian model with a fixed number of firms. Each owns a positive measure of varieties. These varieties are Cobb-Douglas across each other. So innovation step size determines markup and profits under the assumption of Bertrand competition. Now, there are really, you know, many ways to specify innovation cost. One common way in the literature is to assume firms with more varieties actually have lower costs in ways that if the cost becomes proportionally lower as firm size increase, as in Michael Peters' paper, then innovation intensity will be proportional with firm size, which generates Jibrat's law. But here, innovation costs are assumed to be additively independent of firm size. So innovation intensity is not a function of size. Growth becomes additive. So no matter what size the firm is, conditioning on innovation efficiency, contribution to growth in levels is the same across all firm sizes, which implies that bigger firms proportionally grow less than smaller firms. So that's one key ingredient. The second ingredient is to introduce heterogeneity in step size, in particular, the two possibilities following a persistent markup chain, so that firms with higher step size actually innovates more. Now, if this step size is persistent, firms that innovate more will tend to get larger over time. So given this persistence, firm size actually end up being correlated with innovation intensity along the BGP. Even though holding the step size constant, innovation intensity is independent of the size. So the key model prediction is, you know, if we have Jibrat's law where growth rate is independent of sales, then the contribution to growth, which is growth rate times size, would just follow a 45 degree line. This is what Jibrat's law would look like. Now, on the other hand, if there are no step size heterogeneity across all firms, that is, if all firms have exactly the same innovation intensity, this contribution to growth would just be completely flat across the size distribution. So this second ingredient of having heterogeneous step size so that firms with higher step innovates more and get larger over time introduce some positive correlation between contribution to growth and firm size, but the correlation is weaker than Jabras' law, and that's predicted by the model. Okay. So that's the summary of the paper. In terms of my quibbles, so I'm going to again write PE ratio in terms of earning in the next period because it makes the expression simpler. So let's assume that earning in the next period it is known, but in the future, returns and growth are stochastic. So the PE ratio is actually expected of the Gordon growth formula. When both R and G are deterministic, we recover this relationship used essentially in the paper, that growth is negatively related to earning, or the inverse PE ratio. But any randomness in this earning or in the discount rate or growth would introduce error in this measurement. That is, mechanically, we're measuring growth as a function that's negatively related to earnings. So if there are randomness in this, then the Jensen inequality term would generate by construction negative relationship between growth and earnings. So I think the paper should confront this randomness and the Jensen inequality more directly. Now, the paper conducts a robustness exercise using firm-level discount rate rather than just a common market discount rate. And the discount rate is obtained from a different paper by Joel David et al. From JFE. Now, I think, so the model abstract away from risk, and I think the paper should confront risk in a more direct way. That is, even without assuming having any financial friction, so suppose Modigliani theorem actually holds, one can actually incorporate risk in a very simple way. That is, if we consider a cap M model, meaning expected return of a firm depends on the risk-free rate, which is common across all firms, as well as firms' equity beta loading on the risk premium of the market. So cap M just implies this linear relationship between the discount rate and the risk loading on the market risk. So by using a common discount rate across all firms, growth of cyclical firms, of high beta firms, are underestimated. And this issue is actually exacerbated when firms actually differ in leverage. That is, holding earnings constant, the equity beta of a firm is equal to the leverage of the firm times the beta of the cash flow. That is, holding the same risk in cash flow, higher leverage, even without any financial frictions, firm would mechanically have higher beta, therefore having a high discount rate, and growth measured in the data in using a common discount rate will be underestimated. So I feel, you know, this heterogeneity should be incorporated into the model. And the persistence in implied growth is actually quite low. So with an AR1 coefficient of 0.55 implies the half-life is only 1.15 years, okay? Now, this comment is incorrect. Calibration targets exactly this coefficient, but the persistence is quite low. My quibble about the model is that the main role of the model is to quantify growth contribution and markups of firms with different sizes. The main assumptions necessary to take the model to the data are twofold. One is all growth in earnings are due to TFP growth. That is, you know, we're inferring from PE ratios growth in earnings coming from as contribution coming from productivity growth, which rules out rent-seeking behavior like advertising. If I make investment to just grab market share, which doesn't contribute to aggregate growth, that will show up in PE ratio. But you know, by taking a stance on where earning growth comes from in a model, that's ruled out. And the second, the step size process is calibrated to data on profit margins. However, given both of these assumptions, which are required to take the model to the data, one can actually directly describe growth contribution and markup from the data. That is, the PE inversion exercise, which, you know, we back out growth contribution for each individual firm, doesn't require the model. And to do accounting on how much of growth comes from growth in profit margin versus size, that also doesn't require the model. And I have a small technical point about the actual specification, that is, you know, if the law of motion for the number of varieties. Well, for a firm, you know, the law of motion for the number of variety depends on the existing variety times the probability of being destroyed or being taken over by another firm, as well as the innovation intensity of the firm. But given that there are a finite number of firms, there remains a possibility that the firm's innovation hits its own variety. So bigger firm would tend to innovate less for even for a given step size. This is not an issue if the firm is infinitesimally small, but when firms are actually large, this could be an issue. So I tried to provide different micro foundations that could solve this issue to bring back tractability, but I wasn't able to do it. So maybe the paper would consider different ways to specify this equation.
We should finish up, I think.
Yep. So overall, I'm a big fan of the idea of using firm valuation to evaluate growth contribution and market power. It's an idea that I wish I had and written a paper about. Our model is elegant and very simple, so it's potentially easy to introduce various extensions. Incorporating risk in a Modigliani-Miller world is very straightforward in the setting. And the descriptive facts coming out of the PE inversion exercise is also super interesting. So my main empirical suggestion is to formalize risk, even in a simple environment, and to confront Jensen's inequality more head-on. And the model suggestion, I don't have specific suggestion here, but as a reader, I feel the model should be able to squeeze more predictions, you know, in the way it confronts the data, in a way that doesn't come too directly from what's required to write down this model. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.